Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, we are on the air with the V-Spot. I'm Dr. Vic Tater, Victor Rogers. Tonight I'm going to be talking to Peter Sanderson, who has worked as a comic book historian at Marvel and DC. He did significant work on the Handbook of the Marvel Universe and Marvel Saga. Peter, how are you doing?
I'm fine. I'm glad to be on the show.
How did you start working in comics?
Well, that goes back to, when I was in high school, I started writing letters to comic book letter pages back way before the internet, and I was getting published a lot in the Julie Schwartz edited DC Comics letter pages and also at Marvel. And when I came to New York City, moved to New York City to start attending Columbia University grad school, I got contacted by the person who was in charge of fan mail at Marvel, Bonnie Wilford, who was at that time Chris Claremont's girlfriend. And Chris had just started work on the X-Men, and I'd written some nice letters about Chris's early issues. So Bonnie and Chris invited me to meet them for lunch, and I did, and that started a friendship. They were the first comic book pros that I got to know, and through them, I got to know a lot of other people who were my basic generational group at DC and Marvel. And one of whom was Mark Grunewald, who became an editor, an assistant editor at Marvel, and who asked me to start work on his fanzine Omniverse, which is about alternate realities, time travel in Marvel and DC comics. It was in effect about comics history, I was doing work for Mark, and I kept my social contacts up with people at Marvel and DC who are around my age. Started working for various fanzines like Amazing Heroes. And eventually, early 80s, DC was starting to prepare for for projects that they which eventually turned into the history of the DC universe and what eventually became the who's who in the DC universe. And so Len Wein and Marv Wolfman, who were writer-editors of DC at the time, hired me to read through the entire DC Comics library and take research notes for them. And that took about a year of going in two or three times a week to the DC library and reading all of these books. Around the same time, a little later than that, I started, there was an opening for a new assistant editor in the X-Men office, and Mark Grunewald and a few other people recommended me to be the new assistant editor, so I got a staff job at Marvel. And after I'd been on staff for a little over a year, all of a sudden these offers started coming in. They're starting to Mark was starting to launch the Marvel Universe Handbook, the original one. And following that, DC was starting up with the Who's Who. So I started working on these books. I went freelance and I was working on these. And with the Marvel Universe Handbook was the first. And I was in on that, I'd say, from the second issue on. Mark originally had me working on the appendix, which was the short entries at the end of the book for characters who didn't get their own pages. But pretty soon I started writing Marvel Universe Handbook pages, full entries. And by the time that I'd say, within a few issues, I was writing as much as Mark for that series. And when we I think I may have the chronology a bit wrong. I think I was doing the original handbook before I went on staff at Marvel, and then it was after I left staff at Marvel that I worked on the second version of the handbook and the Who's Who.
You mentioned that you read through the entire DC archive to prepare for the Who's Who in the history of the DC universe. Were there any books or characters that you had not been familiar with before that you became fans of in that process?
I think I got Well, when I say the entire DC library, that's a bit of an overstatement because I really didn't have to do things like read like the Funny Animals comics or things like the Honeymooners comic or the Sergeant Bilko comic or Jerry Lewis or Bob Hope. Although I did sneak peeks at some of this stuff, and some of the Funny Animals stuff was turning up in Captain Carrot at the time, so I thought I should look at that. But I'd say that I was pretty much aware of most of the, like, the superheroes from the Silver Age onward. But I really didn't know that much about, like, the war comics. So that was a discovery for me. And I think the big discovery was a lot of the Golden Age material, because apart from some there was a period when DC was doing these, like, 100-page super spectaculars in the 70s, and they were reprinting a lot of Golden Age material. But apart from that, I hadn't really seen much Golden Age stuff. But here I got to not only read about Golden Age characters that I already knew about, like Dr. Fate and the Spectre and so forth, but even, like, characters, superheroes that I knew less about, like the Star-Spangled Kid, or Golden Age characters like the Black Pirate, for example, or Slam Bradley, who weren't superheroes that I'd never seen at all. And that was pretty interesting. Or DC at that point didn't have many quality comics or Fawcett comics in the library, but I did discover some of the quality comic superheroes like Miss America, who I'd never heard of before. So that was all pretty interesting. And it's there weren't really any dead spots. I mean, the Golden Age is a little bit misnamed because it was a great time for inventing characters, but most of the stories were not that good. But nonetheless, it really increased my knowledge of comics history tremendously. It also sort of cured me of collecting because I'd already read all this stuff. So I didn't have to go buy any of it. Anyway, go ahead.
The archives that they had at DC at the time, would these be the actual comics, or did they just have Xeroxes?
These were actual comics. Now, Marvel and DC's libraries, very different. Marvel had only... What both companies did was they collected their own comics and bound them together into hardcover books. But Marvel only tried to have one copy of each comic bound, and they were very bad on security. So like virtually every thing from the 60s had vanished, but somebody had stolen it over the years, or more than one person had stolen it. And they didn't have anything that really preceded the 60s. DC, on the other hand, had two bound copies of everything that went back to the mid-1930s. So it's like I was looking at like early issues of like Detective Comics before Batman showed up. And from about 1948 on, they had three copies of everything bound. And they've had very few thefts over the years. So DC really does an admirable job of preservation. And this, of course, they had been doing this throughout their whole history, long before anybody thought the comics were worth anything. So that was very impressive, and I hope and trust that DC has kept up the good work. I have no idea what's going on with the Marvel Library, although now they seem to be digitizing everything everything new that they do. So, I mean, you know, now, for example, I'm a subscriber to Marvel's Unlimited digital service, which has a lot of digital copies of stuff especially from the last 10 years.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, about the digital comics, though, because I was thinking, you know, how they could have a digital archive ready. You know,
like I say, I've subscribed to it, but still I get so disappointed, especially when I look at stuff from, say, I'm researching stuff in the 80s, and they have some of these comics, but not others. I mean, it's much more complete for early 21st century, because now I think they just digitize everything when they... automatically because they're selling both hard copies and digital copies. But they still haven't really digitized enough from past enough 20th century comics. But anyway, also keep in mind that when I was reading through the DC library or when I was doing work researching in the Marvel library for things for the Marvel Handbook and things, projects like that, this is before regular libraries, public libraries, started collecting comic books. So it's like, unless you were going to go buy all these comics, and of course a lot of Golden Age comics were pretty costly, and even Silver Age comics at that point were going up in price because this is like the 80s. It's like that would have been a pretty expensive proposition, and it would take an awful long time. I'd never be able to get all of them. I mean, in a way, this wasn't very much a comic fan's dream come true to be able to have access to read all of this stuff.
I remember back when I was a teenager, back in the mid-90s, you know, and even then, you know, there weren't a lot of options, even when you were going to get trade paperbacks of collections.
Right.
You know, and it'd be like, I would read mainly quarter books, I'd find, you know, because, you know, they'd just be basically, you know, whatever I could find that was cheap. And that was one thing I appreciated reading the Marvel Handbook, because I got an essential. That's what got me the bug. I found an essential Book of the Dead, and I'm reading this, and I was thinking how much work went into it, because I'm thinking that we take for granted the Wikipedia age we're in, where, you know, you could find so many online sources about characters and stuff, but back then, you know, there wasn't any of that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was about to bring up Wikipedia and things like that. Yes, this is, of course, before the Internet, before Wikipedia, but also, you know, I've done some work with more recent versions of the Marvel Universe Handbook, and one thing that the people who work on that insist on is don't rely on Wikipedia and online sources. Try to read the original material whenever you can. Because Wikipedia, I find in my own experience, Wikipedia is pretty usually gets things right with regard to comics, but you can't be sure, and you can't be sure of fan sites either. My feeling is, you know, if I read something on Wikipedia or on a fan-run website about comics history, I have to get it confirmed. I have to check it out. The thing about, whereas when I was working for Marvel in DC, I had access to the actual comics. I had, and what we were doing was the official version. And on the handbook, we were even able to invent, you know, continuity to fill gaps in some cases, and, you know, as long as we got approval from the people who were in charge of those particular characters, that was fine. And also, but yeah, I'm really amazed at in the early 21st century is really like this golden age for researching comics history, because, I mean, yeah, there are the fan sites to the extent, and Wikipedia to the extent that you can trust them. But also, you've got, you know, I think Marvel's online, unlimited online archive is a great resource, albeit very incomplete. And also, you've just got so much that's available through reprints and even throughout Marvel and DC history. I mean, to be able to... I've been a little put off over the years about how expensive that the DC and archives and Marvel Masterworks editions have been. You know, like paying $60 for these hardcover reprints. But since then, DC and Marvel have been making these available and a lot of this material available in inexpensive trade paperback format. And it's public libraries are collecting a lot of Marvel and DC material, and it's much, much easier than when I was growing up to be able to read the stuff from past decades. And, you know, one of the things that certain editors and writers have said over the decades is, we don't have to care about comics history because it's only a handful of people who know about this stuff from way back when. Well, guess what, folks? In the early 21st century, thanks to all these reprint editions and thanks to all these digital copies online, it's like anybody, the youngest fan, can go back and read stuff from the 30s, the 40s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. All of this stuff is available in the present day. And so it's like when people say, oh, nobody cares about that stuff because it's so far back in the past. No, it exists now in the present. People can easily find and read it. And I also think that this should, you know, and present-day editors and writers should watch out because if they think that, because, you know, if you're doing, say, Batman, say, okay, the readers can easily compare what you're doing to Batman on Batman to what Frank Miller and Steve Englehart and Denny O'Neill and other great Batman writers of the past were doing, you know? Or they can compare the artwork that's in today's comics to, you know, the heights of like Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko from their prime. I think Mark Evanier has written that almost everything that Kirby did at this point in comics in his career is now available in print. And even if some of these reprint editions over the last 15 years have gone out of print, you could still find them on Amazon. So it's really wonderful. But again, I was doing this research for the Who's Who and the original handbooks back before any of this was available. When you either had to rely on your own collection or, since I was had moved to New York, I was able to go into the Marvel and DC offices and look at their stuff. And in the case of Marvel, I could even, if I had to, you know, borrow copies from someone like Mark Gruenwald if the Marvel offices didn't have them. I'm still carrying my collection around with me. It's like I've moved twice over the last few years, but I still, you know, I still bring all of my old Marvel and DCs along with me because I still need them for reference.
Yeah, I tell you, my collection's not very big, but I've got it in the closet. I've taken just about buying essentials at this point because I dread digging in my closet so much.
Yeah, well, I've got half my apartment is basically just storage for books and magazines and clothes and electronic equipment, but mostly the comics collection.
One thing I wanted to ask about, because I got the Marvel Saga, too, recently, and I was reading it, you know, and these things were really invaluable resource, especially in the context of the mid-1980s, you know, when so many of these Silver Age early Marvels weren't available. How did you get the job to work on that project?
I always had the project, and I don't really recall who came up with the idea for it, but it was always me and Danny Fingeroth as editor, although there was another editor for the final issues. I don't recall how exactly it came up, but it was sort of an obvious good idea to try to trace Marvel history from Fantastic Four number one on through the present, and unfortunately we never got all the way to the present day, but we ended the series on a good note, which was the Galactus trilogy, and we were not just trying to figure out, you know, which story happened at which time, and, you know, try to figure out a chronology for everything, but also to insert, you know, like flashback sequences that had been written. Where did those happen in between the original Stan Lee Silver Age stories? So every once in a while somebody suggests to me, you know, they should do Marvel Saga again, and I would like to, although I know virtually nobody at Marvel these days, so I don't know how I'd get such a thing launched. But, you know, Marvel really hasn't Marvel has done more handbooks in recent years, although they seem to have stopped a few years for the last few years, they haven't done any, so, but they haven't really, I think they've used the name Marvel Saga, but they really haven't done a new version of Marvel Saga that's, you know, the same sort of project that we were doing back in the 80s. I liked doing that. We had to do it on the cheap because I think it worked best when we were able to hire artists to do new art for the project instead of just doing these, but, you know, it had its own interest doing these sort of clip art from old stories.
Yeah, I got to the issue with the X-Men history where, and it did, I thought you did a great job combining the retcons or that they'd shown of Xavier's past, like in the 80s, and the stuff with Cyclops, you know, and as I'm sure you know, Cyclops' history kind of became a mess over the years as they kept putting more and more stuff into his backstory.
Oh, yeah. Now, I think there's a real need to do a new Marvel saga, and I'd love to have the challenge of doing it because they have, for example, not just, you know, putting more stuff into Cyclops' history, you know, giving him another brother but Wolverine's backstory is now immensely long and complicated. And because when he shows up in Marvel Saga the first time, he's up working with Alpha Flight, but now we'd have a whole lot more backstory to give him. So I'd love to do it. I don't know how much market there is for a project like that. But then again, sometimes I think that, you know, the people who are still reading Marvel and DCs are the hardcore continuity types.
Well, you know, I think it would be an interesting project to just do something like that as a digital comic.
Oh, sure, you could do it as a digital comic if Marvel or DC was willing to pay someone to do it. And because also with a digital comic, you could do for example, we could still start, if we do a new Marvel Saga and it was done digitally, we could still start basically the same way that I did originally, which was, you know, where was everybody on the day that the Fantastic Four went into outer space and got their powers? But, say, when we show what Wolverine's been up to, then we could have a link to a section about Wolverine's backstory up to that point. Or we could do a version of Marvel Saga. This is just occurring to me off the top of my head. You could do a version of Marvel Saga where every time you refer to a story from the past, you do a link to the digital edition on Marvel's website of that issue.
That way
would be a great way for Marvel or DC with a project like that to, you know, sell back issues in digital form.
I actually ended up with a similar idea to that because I run a blog where I do stories and I kind of put a chapter a day. And what I took to doing when I started getting a little continuity heavy, I started putting links to the previous chapter and like a footnote area.
Uh-huh.
You know, so it was interesting you brought that up. I was curious, when you were working on Marvel Universe Handbook, was there any continuity that proved to be a real mess or it was difficult to fix?
Sure, there were some, but it wasn't all... But, you know, there weren't really that many of them, and they really weren't that bad. I'd say that one that comes to mind is that Stan Lee and Jack Kirby had done, you know, they did the story in Avengers 4 about how Baron Zemo, the original one, launched that drone plane into the air that had a bomb on it. And Cap and Bucky were both trying to on the top of the plane trying to stop it, and Bucky gets killed. Although now, of course, he wasn't really killed. And Cap goes into suspended animation. And this was supposed to happen before the end of World War II in Europe. However, Stan and Jack also did a story in the Silver Age about Cap's last wartime battle with the Red Skull, which supposedly happened during the fall of Berlin at the end of World War II in Europe. So I had to. So what I did was, when I was writing the entries about Cap and Bucky and the Red Skull, I concocted this chronology where Cap was sent Cap to Berlin at the end of World War II to have his fight with the Red Skull, and then he had to head from Berlin into London, so he could be at that British airbase when Baron Zemo took it over and launched the drone plane. So I was trying to fit these two stories together, whereas it obviously had never occurred to Lee and Kirby that these two stories contradicted each other continuity-wise, having Cap in basically two places at once in the final days of the war. So, but there really weren't that many tangles like that. For the most part, you know, even despite Stan's renowned bad memory, he kept things going. He kept things. He didn't really screw up continuity in any important ways. And the initial wave of writers who followed him, Roy Thomas, of course, was a big fan of comics history, a big student of comics history, and the writers that Stan and Roy brought in, you know, the first wave, like Steve Englehart and Jerry Conway and Len Wein and Marv Wolfman, they were all paying attention to the stories of the 60s, and they were trying to do their best to stay faithful to them. You know, the idea of changing past history at will or on whim is something that's really more true of current mainstream comics writers. And, I mean, I remember, and this is like in the 80s when things were beginning to change. I remember I was talking to somebody who was working in the Batman editorial department. No, not Denny O'Neill. And I mentioned Dark Knight had recently come out, and I had Frank Miller's Dark Knight, and I mentioned that Batman Year One. And I mentioned that Frank was giving Catwoman a different origin than she had originally. And this guy from the Batman editorial department said, Catwoman had a different origin? And what I was thinking was, if you're in the Batman editorial department, it is your job to know the origins of these characters. But it's like, yeah. I think now it's like there's a certain mindset on the part of certain editors and writers that who cares? I mean, we don't care about this stuff. I mean, especially at say DC where continuity is constantly in flux, that we don't have to know about this stuff. We can change it. We can do whatever we want. And again, I think this is a mistake because like I say, the past stories are more available now than ever.
And, if you ask, you know, as a reader, I always have the feeling, you know, as a reader, if the editors don't care, why should I care as a reader?
Well, I think that I've written about this elsewhere, that I think that one of the biggest problems that's going on continuity these days, you mentioned the Marvel Book Universe Handbooks, Book of the Dead, for example. And because back then, if a character was pronounced dead and put in the Book of the Dead, that meant he was really dead. And we're not talking about, you know, like when, you know, there's at the end of a Doctor Doom story when there's a big explosion and but they never find Doctor Doom's body. And we all know that's a game and that Doctor Doom somehow escaped. And a writer like John Byrne would understand that, well, you have to explain how he got away in the next time you use him. But now it's like, you know, characters have been killed off and brought back so many times in recent years. Or, you know, like Spider-Man and Superman, they've been married for 20 years, and then, oops, sorry, we've changed our mind, and we undo Spider-Man's marriage with a deal with the devil, and we undo Superman's marriage just by rebooting the series. And it's like, you know, nothing counts, nothing matters. You know, if you see some major change in a character now, for all you know, a year from now, some other editor or writer, or maybe even the same ones, will undo it. So it's like, you know, there's just not the sense that continuity is important anymore.
It becomes, like I said, it becomes harder to invest in the story as a reader. It's
you can't really invest in emotionally in what happens to the characters if, as you've seen, anything that happens to them can be so easily undone.
One thing I noticed about the Book of the Dead is that some of the Western heroes were included in there, like Sir Percy was included in there. How did y'all come to that decision to put those characters in the Book of the Dead as opposed to the main handbook?
Oh, well, because they didn't live in the present day, so they were by definition dead. They lived in past centuries. And the reason why those characters were included was because they had been used in contemporary superhero stories, you know, because the modern-day Black Knight has, you know, the ghost of his ancestor, Sir Percy, has appeared to him, so that character has been, the ghost of the original Black Knight had from the 1950s stories that Stanley wrote had appeared in modern Marvel Universe stories. And similarly, Steve Englehart had been the one who did a time travel story in the Avengers that used Kid Colt and the Two-Gun Kid and the Rawhide Kid and the character who's now known as the Phantom Rider. And so,
right.
And then he used them again in West Coast Avengers. So it's so they too had been part of the modern Marvel universe. So we decided to include those in the books of the Dead. And you know, again, then they all lived in past centuries. So by definition, they're dead. That doesn't mean they couldn't still be used in time travel stories, or you still couldn't have the ghost of Sir Percy show up as he has. And I think I was actually impressed by Marvel when they did their 70th anniversary year that they actually even brought back lots more characters from past decade from the Golden Age, and it's like who not even Roy Thomas had brought back in books like The Invaders. So they in some ways they're paying more attention to their history in recent years.
Yeah, it's. I think it's better in recent years than it was in the first part of the last decade.
Yeah, well, again, there seemed to be this around the 70th anniversary. There seemed to be a lot of they did all these special 70th anniversary issues. They brought in which they spotlighted Golden Age characters, and they brought back a bunch who had not been brought back before. So. There was that series, The Marvels Project, which actually sort of had as a frame. Didn't it start out like with the death of the Two-Gun Kid in like the 1930s? And the Angel from Marvel Comics number one was in that series, and it was on the other hand, I recently was reading an interview with some current Marvel writers and editors in which they were asked about some story that happened with a character in the 80s, and one of them said, "I don't think we know anybody who was working on the books back then." And I thought, well, that's not good. You know, and their basic attitude was, well, that story was 30 years ago. We don't really care about it. And again, I think of Marvel and DC as having these really rich histories that you could draw upon. And I think, for example, the model of how to handle a long-range continuity is what's going on with Doctor Who now, which is, it's been around for 50 years as of this year. But they have never rebooted Doctor Who. They've never said that past continuity never existed. Now, you can watch the new series without having to have seen any of the shows from past decades. Because, if they introduce a concept from the past, they will explain it for new viewers. But on the other hand, the old stories are still part of the continuity, and the BBC is happily selling DVDs and of the old series. And I think that's the best way to go. Don't get rid of the past, but don't be so slavishly reliant on it that nobody can appreciate the new stories without understanding the past. Be able to appeal both to new viewers and to old time fans. And don't demean your own history. Something that struck me is that even periods of comics history that fall out of favor can come back into favor. Like when Grant Morrison was writing Batman in recent years, he was bringing back characters and concepts from the late 50s and early 60s that had been in disrepute for decades, and he was making them work. So you see, you get rid of past continuity at your own peril. Because just because you at the present time can't think of something good to do with that past continuity doesn't mean that someone else won't be able to use it in a good way later on.
And also, it's one of those things that every character is somebody's favorite. I was reading, a friend of mine had me read a New Avengers issue, which I still hold, which I'm still mad at him about because I hated it. But the story had them just ragging on these D list, you know, the lower rung characters, you know, and I was thinking, why is it necessary, you know, to just bring these characters back just to crap on them? You know, when somebody else could do something good.
Well, I don't know. I don't know exactly which story you're referring to, but I agree with the basic, or your basic idea. There have been of course characters, for example, like it really bugs me when you, when writers kill off like a Stan Lee and Jack Kirby character, or a Stan Lee Steve Ditko character, because, you know, maybe the editor and writer at the time thinks that there's nothing more that can be done with those characters, but invariably, these characters get brought back, and somebody else has come up with brand new ideas about how to use them and makes them work. And so people should. But now I think a lot of writers and editors are cynical about this sort of thing. Oh, we'll kill the character off for a few years, and you know, bring it. It's just become like this really long time out for the character. We'll kill him off, and then we'll bring him back in a few years. You know, at least when in the past, when Roy Thomas killed off Professor X, I think he actually meant to do it. And then when he realized it was a mistake, he brought him back. Now I think characters just get killed off to try to give a shock effect to the jaded readers who keep falling for this over and over and over. You know, last few years we've had, well, you know, Captain America fake dies and comes back, and followed by the Human Torch fake dying coming back, and the Wasp fake dying and coming back, and you know, currently Spider-Man, Peter Parker is supposedly dead, but you know, nobody really believes that, and it's like just tiresome to me. You know, I don't believe in any death scene at DC or Marvel Comics anymore.
One thing I wanted to ask you is, you worked on the handbook for so long, were there any characters you came across in doing those that you felt had potential to be more than they were?
More than they were?
Like, they might have been the character that, you know, they weren't used to often, but it seemed like they had potential to be a great character.
I don't know if that's so true about Marvel, because I think that Marvel when I was working on the handbooks at Marvel pretty much throughout the 80s, and so I was working on various different versions of the handbook. There were the original ones that were 32 pages long, and then there was the deluxe edition that was longer, but still in comics pamphlet form, and there were trade paperbacks of those version, and sometimes we added material to those. And then there were the loosely format versions, and there were these various update series. And I worked on all of these throughout the 80s, and I guess into the start of the 90s. And but I don't know if that's true so much about DC characters. I mean Marvel characters, because I think that by then there are enough writers and enough books so that if any character of significance from the Silver Age was probably being used by somebody. And I know that, for example, one of Mark Gruenwald's policies was to bring back characters from the past who had potential if he thought that they were being underused. You know, that the idea was don't create a new character if there's an existing character who's just as good or better to be used in that way. Now at DC, I think I would come across characters where I'd say, yeah, there's a character who hasn't been used in decades, and maybe many people aren't aware of him, and I just all liked him because that's what comes of reading through the DC library, that especially like all these Golden Age stories, you'd find all these forgotten characters or characters who are underused and say, you know, that character wasn't so bad. Like, I'll tell you one that just pops into my head. In the 1940s, Superman was fighting, you know, Superman had a bunch of regular villains in the 1940s. There was Lex Luthor, of course. And there was Mr. Mixyez Pitalik, who back then was drawn differently, and his name was Mr. Mixyez Tipalik back then. They spelled it differently later on. But he was also fighting these sort of trickster characters, like the Toy Man and the Prankster, who have been brought back in recent years. And another villain that he kept fighting over and over again was a guy named J. Wilbur Wolfingham, who was had no superpowers, but he was this con man. And, you know, he couldn't really menace Superman physically, but he kept coming up with these schemes that where Superman had to outwit him. And one of the things about Wolfingham was that he looked to me like W.C. Fields, if W.C. Fields had a shaved head and a monocle. And I thought the idea of Superman having to continually running up against this guy who looked and acted and talked like W.C. Fields was just so amusing. And I wish somebody would do a story bringing this guy back. And I made sure that this guy was included in the Who's Who. But nobody has, except for Steve Gerber came up with a character who had the same name but was entirely different. I thought, no, that's not the point. The point is that the Superman was fighting a supervillain who was like W.C. Fields. So, you know, that's just a minor example. But it's like, I mean, there's all sorts of characters, especially like Golden Age superheroes that say, oh, look at like the Ray and the Black Condor that Lou Fine used to draw for Quality Comics in the 40s in D.C., DC owns them, and they became part of the Freedom Fighters. Well, you know, these are good characters, and they should be used more often, and they have been in subsequent years.
Mr. Sanderson, we're about to run out of time. Do you have any current projects you would like to mention?
Well, I'd just say that, you know, we've mostly been talking about what I was doing in the 80s, but starting in the 90s, I started writing books about comics history, mostly about Marvel, so like The Ultimate Guide to the X-Men and Marvel Universe, and was one of the contributors to the Marvel Encyclopedia, and the official travel guide to Marvel's version of New York City. And so between books like those and reprints of stuff that I'm doing, like for the handbooks and the Marvel Saga, I've got like something like 20 different books on Amazon.com you can find. And what I've been doing recently, and I also for, you know, 5 years was doing a blog about comics history and comics criticism that started out on IGN and was on various other websites. And what I'm doing now is I'm working on a book about the comic books of the year 1986, which was a year when you had Watchmen and Mouse and Dark Knight and Man of Steel and all sorts of landmark comics. And I'm writing this for a small publisher called Sequart, Sequart. And they've been serializing chapters of the book as I write them on their website. So I suggest that your readers check this out. And eventually this will become a book and published book. And I have ideas for another book that's going to follow after that.
Sir, thank you very much for joining us. They're about to cut us off in a minute.
Okay. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and I hope we do this again, because I could have gone much longer with this, to tell you the truth. I've been enjoying this.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun. Thank you very much, sir.
Okay, thank you. Shall I sign off now?
All right.
Okay,
yes, sir.
Bye. Okay, yes. Bye.
Bye-bye. We'll be back Saturday at 1 p.m. I will be talking to Glenn Greenberg, former Spider-Man editor. Good night, everybody.